So, first of all, thank you very much, Helen, for offering your time to talk to our students about careers in the art market. And again, just to summarize here a little bit for everyone, you've had a fantastic career, classics major from Oxford, and by the way, go into gemstone industry seems to be a huge passion, so we're really looking forward to hearing more about that. And then you work for these two enormous auction houses, Sotheby's and Christie's, which is of course a big name. And then you went and worked for Gubelin Academy, and that's also really interesting to hear. And now I understand that you're with Gembridge, which seems to be cutting edge online. And I looked at some of the gemstones, and they are huge and beautiful on the website. So anyway, so I just hand it over to you, and thank you again very much for listening.
Oh, thank you so much, Beatrice. I really appreciate your kind introduction, and just huge thank you to you for having me today, and also to Juliana for inviting me. It's really kind of you. I care so much about education. I mean, it kind of shows in my CV. So I'm delighted to be here for anybody who's sort of, you know, in formative years of their university to help sort of give you ideas for the future and maybe just open some of the usually quite obscure doors, shall we say, in an industry that I think a lot of people don't know that much about. So what I'm going to do today, I'm going to sort of give you an overview of the last 20 years of my career. I mean, some of it feels like yesterday, but it's quite long. And I thought I'd do that by showing you some images, if I can just find the presentation, showing you some images of what I've been doing and giving you a bit of an overview exactly of my career from the last 20 years. Forgive me, I'm just trying to find, where is it? Coming up somewhere in a moment. Sorry about this, guys. I should have had it ready to go. There we go. So I've provisionally, I'm hoping you can all see this now, provisionally called this talk the Universe of Jewellery, because it's such a big, enormous topic. And I'd also sort of given this as a very brief overview in the past at my own school, and I'd called it From School to Jewel, because it's exactly this, from the beginning of when I started in the jewellery industry to today. And I think, you know, one of the things I want to do is to give you a brief overview into the jewellery industry, because it is such a complex combination of different businesses and different industries. It's one of the only industries I know that has such a broad number of potential jobs and areas of skill sets. You know, you can go into jewellery because there's gemology, so you're looking at the science of the gems. The geology, not just the science of the gemstones, but where they came from, has become more and more important to us as gem businesses today. The manufacturing side, of course, creating and designing jewels. So there's a very creative as well as a scientific side to our industry. Then, of course, we've got the financial, the investments and the pricing side. People look at gemstones as much as gold these days for putting money into sort of safe value, effectively. And some of the pricing we do is, you know, it's like working in the stock markets. You can price stones off lists effectively. So there's a big financial aspect. And then, of course, the marketing and the sales side of the industry, which are huge when you're working with some of the big brands and some of the very high value goods. So we've got an industry that's extremely diverse, which might mean it could be very interesting for a number of different people. I also think it's one of the few industries that has a combination of science and art. So you could be a scientific mindset and love the gemology, be an art history major. I kind of started with loving the art, and that's how I got into it. You could be interested in history, interested in the finance, maybe you're interested in the business, maybe just the romantic side. If you think of all of the different art types that are out there, looking at the auction houses, for example, jewelry is one of the only ones that nearly everybody's got some involvement in. I can't think of any other world that mixes so many different areas together with an actual object that nearly everybody owns. Someone has given or someone has owned a piece of jewelry across history. You know, it's not the same with the impressionist art collecting market or old antique furniture. You know, everybody we know has owned or bought or given or worn some sort of jewelry. And it's also the only art market area where you are wearing that piece of art or that piece of jewel or that valuable or emotional piece next to your skin. So it has a very, very personal human element to it. So I just wanted to introduce that to you guys because I think it's an extraordinary industry that we're in. And I don't think there's anything comparable to it in terms of variation. And this is one of the reasons that I kind of wanted to go into it. The business has got a little bit of something for everyone. I personally was a bit of an all-rounder, and I like the idea of obviously being a specialist and really getting to know a subject, but the breadth and the variety that this offered. And this was the beginning of my story. I started, obviously, at your age, I was at university. As Bish just kindly said, I was in Oxford, and I did a four-year course studying classics with Trihumaniores. So I was very much into reading Latin and ancient Greek. I was reading the whole of the Iliad in the original language, totally absorbed in the ancient world. I was even sort of, you know, going off to Pompeii in my summer school weekend, summer school vacation to go and dig in the city, and carried on, you know, researching that as well. So I really was following a passion there up until the age of about, 21. And I loved this because it was the importance of history. And I also studied the archaeology and the art very much in my final year and became quite involved with one of the British specialists on gem engraving in the ancient world. So I ended up doing quite a bit on ancient gemstones and realized that I just loved this concept of small scale, high value, beautiful objects. But after Oxford, I had to work out what to do next. Now, I'd effectively just spent 10 years as a classicist. You know, I wasn't really sure what to make of a career after that. I knew I didn't want to go into a museum. It was too staid in a way. It wasn't quite expansive enough. And there were a lot of difficulties in museums in Britain at the time with lots of restructuring. And I wasn't sure what to do. I had seen a lot of my contemporaries do three-year courses. And after their final year, go straight into the banking world, into management consultancy, into jobs that were considered ideal, but they didn't necessarily have a passion for. And I saw the fallout, people not loving their jobs and having a hard first year. So I decided to take 1 year, pick something I absolutely could adore, absolutely out of the box thinking, give it a go. And if it didn't work, give up and go back and do something sensible. So jewelry seemed like an obvious vocation for me. I'd always loved it as a child. I'd always loved gemstones. And it had this combination of academic, international, glamorous, you know, the intellectual together with the financial side. And I thought I'd give this a go. So I went to London straight after finals. I think the third time I'd ever been to the city. And I, you know, realized that I could there find in London jewelry together with the gemstones. And I went to Bond Street, the big main shopping center for all the sort of high-end jewelry and couture in the city. And I just knocked on doors and I asked the different jewelry dealers how to get into the industry and how they could give me some advice on what I might need to know. It was a very interesting time because I look back and think what an extraordinary lack of fear I had. I didn't have anything to lose because I didn't know any of these people. And if they closed the door, they closed the door. But I learned so much in that 1 week. I got seven job offers and took one of them up and went straight up to London to work. Actually in a small market, in a jewellery market, so it was really from scratch. But I got a lot of very blunt responses from some of the big jewellery dealers in London. One of the biggest antique jewellery dealers, I walked in and gave them my CV and said, do you mind giving me some advice on how to get into this industry? And they just looked at me and said, we're not looking for a secretary right now. And I said, I'm not looking for a secretarial job. I'm interested in the specialization of the industry, just a bit of advice. And they said, we're not looking for a secretary. And it was very clear I was going to be entering an industry that was very old fashioned with a lot of preconceptions. So I'm quite grateful to that because I went in eyes wide open. I knew it wasn't going to be easy. But at the same time, you know, of course, things have changed in 20 years. If you love something and you want to do it, you make it happen. And I'm a very strong believer in commitment to something you want to do and also very hard work to get there. So eyes wide open is where I went in. I had another jewelry dealer on Bond Street who actually was even more blunt. He said to me, you're crazy if you want to go into this industry. You're not male, you're not Jewish, and you don't come from a big dealing factory. Go off and be a lawyer. So again, I was given all of the preconceptions quite sort of full on. But again, I think this is also something that anybody starting out in their career has to be aware that you're quite often going into an industry that's got its preconceptions. Obviously, some of them are not ones that I would advise that anybody had, but at the same time, it was a really, really big growth experience for me to start off at that very full-on experience. So I started this job in this little market, and the first thing you have to do if you're serious about jewellery is you have to learn to be a gemologist. You have to study gemology. So the second thing I did, again, within a week, I was enrolled on the gemological diploma course with the Gemological Association of Great Britain. I studied every single night and every single weekend I had. It was a sort of 18 months to 2 year course, night school, that I did outside of working. And I fell in love with gemology. I had always been a humanities person up until this point, and the pure science of it, I just adored. I realized I was probably a scientist at heart as much as a humanities person. It also came quite easy. I was very fortunate with my classical knowledge of Latin and Greek. A lot of gemology is about learning another language. You have to learn words like refraction and birefringence and pleochroism and chatoyancy. Well, that one's a bit French, but obviously a lot of the roots of gemology are Latin and Greek. So this was also quite a natural study for me in some way. But I discovered I fell in love with gemology. I got that sort of added on degree with distinction. I think I got one of the highest marks in Europe at the time. Loved it, like I said. I think if you love something, you apply yourself. And really that became the perfect combination of sort of science and history for me. You know, you have the history of the jewelry and the science of the gems. And with that, within a year, I was extraordinarily fortunate. I had got into the very competitive Sotheby's graduate training scheme. And that was a fast track scheme to get, I suppose, potential young managers into different departments. You know, I was initially sent into the ceramics department, which I was not keen on initially, fell in love with that too, actually really enjoyed the historical side of working with Meissen and Sèvres and all the glass. I had bit of a turning point there as well, I must admit. The department, I think, were quite keen to keep me at one point, and I was quite keen to stay. I loved it. But I used to get sent down to the front desk at Sotheby's, this was in Bond Street, to go and pick up pieces of porcelain that might be needing valuation by the experts in the department, because the department was quite far away from the front office. And there was a one point where they gave me a Viennese coffee can, which is like a Viennese coffee cup from the 18th century. And I had to get quite a few different departments to get there and up several stairs and one very small, old, winding, old staircase. And on the way back down to the department, I tripped. And I dropped this Viennese 18th century coffee cup. And in slow motion, I just saw this beautiful fine piece of porcelain just roll one step at a time down a flight of 12 steps. I got to the bottom of the stairs, picked it up, and there wasn't even a chip, nothing. The thing was perfectly intact. That was the moment I thought, I'm going to stick to diamonds. I think that was really like a big turning point in the actual industry within the auctions that I wanted to stay in. So within that first year of working on the training scheme, they earmarked me for jewellery because I had the FGA, the Fellow of the Gemological Association, and they sent me to Geneva. So that was how I ended up in Geneva. It was my first year with Sotheby's in 2001, and the beginning of 10 years working for both Sotheby's and Christie's as a jewellery specialist in Geneva and also in London. That was, again, you know, what an amazing experience, 10 years of my life working for two of the biggest names in the art and the auction industry. It was very long days. I was a jewellery cataloguer initially, which of course is the training work really to get you into becoming a specialist. It gives you the experience. I probably in Geneva in that first year, I think handled probably something well over $50 million of jewellery in that first year, just handling it to catalogue it and to describe it for the printed catalogues. But I must admit, some of those days were wonderful and some of them were really hard. As fun as it sounds working in the jewellery departments and the auctions, when you get started, I spent hours just calculating diamond weights, counting diamonds, calculating weights, doing condition reports, and it can get super competitive, repetitive. So, you know, some of these early days, we were putting in 12-hour days cataloging over and over again, just counting numbers, multiplications. But you find your ways to deal with that. And one of the ways I found of handling that was by making the most of the objects around me, wearing them whenever you could. And of course, that's the bonus side to working with these beautiful items that are wearable. You get to try them all on. We also had some, you know, quite fun times in the auction houses. And when we were quite young in the early days, we had a pug in the office, a pug dog that was called E.T. because I don't think it was particularly beautiful. And the owner had a very good sense of humor. And E.T. used to come into the office every day. And one of my colleagues thought it would be hilarious one day to put a pair of 10 carat DIF, that's perfect diamonds, on its ears as a pair of earrings. And this dog did a runner. I can remember spending 15 minutes chasing it around the office for $1 million worth of diamonds on its ears. So rule number one, don't work with animals and stick to wearing the jewelry yourself, I think. So we obviously, you know, had huge access to huge amounts of jewelry. This was the magnificent sales in Geneva specifically. And then after my first year in Geneva with Sotheby's, I got called back to London and was running my own jewellery sales, much lower value, 200-300 francs at a time pieces. So that was a great experience. Went from magnificent to lower value and sort of handling everything and anything that somebody might come in with. And then moved back into the higher end sales. And in 2006, just at the age of, I think, 26 or something, I was asked to become the specialist in charge of the sale of Princess Margaret, who was the sister of the Queen of England. I got a call from the head of Christie's that day. I'll never forget it. I'll never forget. He said, right, you're good at history and research. I want you to do a valuation. And the heirs to Princess Margaret, who she died a few years previously, needed to split the estate for inheritance tax and various death duties and also just administratively. And it was her personal collection. And I was sent one Wednesday morning to Kensington Palace, where I found myself with a colleague sitting at the kitchen table in Princess Margaret's old apartments, while one of the world's most famous jewellery collectors, somebody who was also based in Geneva at the time, opened a vintage bottle of champagne while Princess Margaret's son started pulling pieces out of the safe. And that was just the beginning of, I mean, such a career highlight and such an extraordinary position to find myself in, frankly, my 20s. It was just an amazing sale. And for one of the reasons that I really, really love about jewellery and the jewellery industry, it wasn't just that it was royal. Obviously, that was super exciting and why everybody else got so excited. But it was a very personal collection. You know, these weren't royal jewels as such. They were pieces that were private that belonged to a member of the royal family. And that was what I found so lovely. These were pieces that somebody actually wore and had huge emotional and potentially familial significance. The most famous piece, of course, was the most royal looking one. It was the Baltimore tiara, the one you see on the right. You can see here Princess Margaret wearing it actually on her wedding day to Lord Snowdon in 1960. And unusually, this tiara was bought secondhand at auction in 1959 for her to wear on her wedding day. I think you've seen in all the royal weddings recently, it's always been pieces lent by the Queen. Very unusual to see one bought for a member of the royal family. But that was, I think, also for her to really have her own piece of jewelry that she could continue to wear throughout her life. And one of the reasons I'm sure that it was purchased, one of the reasons I particularly loved it, was that you could take it to pieces into sort of lots of different bits of jewelry. It made a fringe necklace, brooches, even pieces for your hair. And that really is one of the key aspects to proper antique jewelry. It should be highly versatile. But I do remember I got this back to the office after doing the valuation. I was so excited. It comes with little screwdrivers in the box. I was taking it apart, playing with it. And I had an appointment with one of the top journalists, jewelry journalists in the world. And it took me an hour and I only just got it back together in time. It was really fiddly screwdrivers, put it all back together again. It was like sort of an engineering feat. So again, another aspect to jewelry, sort of the engineering side, very, very key. This particular tiara sold for over £1 million, but it was also one of the only tiaras I've been expressly told I was not allowed to wear or try on. We were not allowed to try on any of the royal jewellery from the Princess Margaret sale, which is something I'll always be a bit sad about, but I also got to handle everything. You'll see that I'm in a lot of the photographs for the Margaret sale, and it was because I was specialist in charge and one of only three specialists allowed to touch the pieces. So that meant I had to do all the handling for press. The actual sale itself, I did all the research. I did all the cataloguing. I put the whole sale together. It was sort of 15-hour days easily, absolute commitment to this over 6 months, no life. But what an extraordinary experience. And I got to handle the engagement ring and the wedding tiara and pieces that, like I said, were really, really personal. If you look at the brooch in sapphire and diamonds, the top, it was a 1930s sapphire and diamond deco brooch. This was really lovely. This was a piece that came with a note, and the note inside said, "For darling Margaret on her confirmation day from her loving granny Mary. God bless you." Now that was Queen Mary. And some of these pieces, as we were opening them initially in the kitchen at Kensington Palace, even the family hadn't seen some of the notes inside the pieces. And to be opening boxes that were given to you by your grandmother, but she was a Queen of England, just can't tell you how exciting that is. Handwritten notes from a queen to the sister of the queen, just beautiful, you know. And obviously this was a family piece of jewellery, so there's that personal element. That was particularly personal as well. The ruby ring on the left, that was a very important ring in the sense it was all Burmese rubies. It was estimated at £15,000 to £20,000 and sold for £300,000. The pearl necklace in the middle at the bottom was probably one of the most frequently worn pieces of jewellery of Princess Margaret's, and maybe her favourite. She wore it in all of her early 20s birthday and annual portraits by Cecil Beaton, and you'll see it in many of her images. And the Poltimore tiara, like I said, it came to pieces as a fringe necklace. So here it is actually being worn as the necklace version. And the Riviera on the bottom right, another piece with a note in it. The note just simply said, when we opened the box, "The Lady Mount Stephen." So I went off and looked all this up, and Lady Mount Stephen was the lady-in-waiting to Queen Mary. So this was the Queen Mary who'd given Princess Margaret the brooch, and Lady Mount Stephen had left her jewellery collection to Queen Mary, who had then given more pieces to Princess Margaret. Both the necklace and the tiara made the £1 million mark each. So it was pretty exciting sale. I had to take all the pieces on tour. So I took them around England. I can tell you this now, but I couldn't at the time. We were in the back of a white unmarked van with ex-Marine soldiers to keep the security but to keep very low profile. And I traveled around Geneva, Hong Kong, New York to take these pieces on view. And that was the beginning of many Hong Kong trips for me, because later in my career, I had quite a big Hong Kong aspect to it. So that was the Princess Margaret sale. Wonderful highlight at Christie's. And since then, I've handled quite a lot of other famous royal jewels. Just some examples from the last few years. These are ones that are really in the last 2 or 3 or 4 years, really. There was a beautiful piece of Napoleon's he gave to his mistress, the Countess Waleska, a Polish lady that came up for sale recently that I got to handle at $225,000. Probably one of the most important pieces of jewellery in the last two decades, Marie Antoinette's pearl. $36 million for a single pearl pendant. That was tripling the previous world record for pearls. And again, also from Geneva, and that came up at Sotheby's a couple of years ago. One of my favourite pieces from Catherine the Great was the Catherine the Great emerald, which originally belonged to the Grand Duchess Vladimir, the same as the Vladimir tiara in the crown jewels of England, which is the quite famous one with the pearl drops that I think we've seen a few members of the family wearing recently. And the Duchess of Windsor sale. She was married to the king who abdicated because she was a divorced American. And that was one of the biggest sales in 1987 that came up in Geneva, but the pieces came back again. Now, this particular bracelet might not look like much. It's a material called blue chalcedony. So it's just a quartz, But the set of the two bracelets and necklace sold for just under $1 million when it came round for sale the second time round a few years ago. I got to see it because I was called out to work on the collection of the buyer, who was a big collector in Asia, and to help work on that. But it really shows you that the provenance value can add so much to a piece of jewellery, as well as the design. You know, all these others have got intrinsic value in the actual stones, but this bracelet made by Suzanne Belperron was a real design piece that was pushed up in value because of its provenance background with the Duchess of Windsor, who was just one of the greatest jewellery collectors in the world. And I've actually worked with several pieces that belong to these last three ladies. The French and Russian crown jewels pieces often come up for auction again. Both collections were originally dispersed on the public market in the early 20th century. So that means the pieces reappear and we've got them catalogued, so we know where they've come from. So I find that very exciting, the opportunity to see pieces that have once been brought to sale come back on the market again. And when you're talking about the very high end of the jewellery market, these pieces stay relevant. You know, they keep a value and they stay known for what they are and very much appreciated for that provenance value. The background to where these pieces come from, royal collections, it doesn't get much better. So those are a few of the collections I've worked with in my times in the auctions and seen recently. You know, the actual collectors themselves, we've mentioned Princess Margaret, her sale when it came up, we sold that for $17 million. So that was quite a nice sale value for the wholesale. Some of the pieces were selling for 20 times the sale estimate. You know, they were going crazy compared with what they were worth as a piece of jewellery. Lily Safra, that was a collection that came up for Christie's a few years ago. The wife, the philanthropist and wife of Edmund Safra, the banker. She sold her jewellery collection in 2012 in Geneva for charity, and that made $35 million. I mentioned the Duchess of Windsor, but also Elizabeth Taylor, one of the greatest jewellery collectors of all time. You talk about one of the best rubies, one of the best emeralds, one of the best sapphires, and Elizabeth Taylor will be mentioned somewhere. Her collection was sold for $116 million in 2011 at Christie's. Hers had been the previous world record pearl for $10 million prior to the Marie Antoinette one, which sold for $36 million. And I can remember at the Elizabeth Taylor sale, I was working on a very important pearl outside of the auctions as well for a collector, which had a royal provenance and was almost the same as her one that was selling. And I held these two pearls in my hand at one point, and that was $10 million each easily. So, you know, quite an extraordinary story there. And then, you know, collections that aren't necessarily sold at auction I've had to work with too. This was the Cheapside Hoard, which was an amazing group of jewels that was found by builders who were working on a house in East London. They pulled up the floorboards, and the most important collection of 17th century jewellery ever intact was discovered. The reason I got to work on this collection was the curator in London asked me to come and look at the pieces because I was quite experienced with ancient gems. So I'd carried on working with engraved Roman and Greek gems. And there were several pieces that were very early. You know, it wasn't all 17th century. There were pieces that were earlier. But this had just extraordinary, extraordinary pieces of jewellery in it. They will be on display when the Museum of London reopens again in its new location in a couple of years at this point. So if you get a chance, that's one to watch and to go to. And those are sort of my key famous collections, but I've got one piece of jewellery that I have to mention was probably one of my favourites that I ever handled. I don't know if any of you recognise this, but it was very famously the tiny little sapphire and diamond coronet that Queen Victoria is seen wearing in many of her portraits by Winterhalter in her younger days and also in her mourning days after Prince Albert died. This was just an extraordinary piece of jewellery. It was going to be sold outside of the royal family. It was going to be sold, and the export to, I think, Asia was stopped by the British government because it was too important for the nation, and it was saved for the nation by a brilliant donation that kept it in the Victoria and Albert Museum finally. And I had also been asked to look at several pieces over my time in the V&A. And I came in and got to see the coronet. I knew a bit about the sapphires at this point, so I could see that certain sapphires potentially had certain origins geologically, that many of them were probably Sri Lankan stones, but possibly a couple of other places too, which made sense because the sapphires had come from old collections and been made up into the coronet. And this was just such a lovely opportunity for me, also because the curator who asked me to look at it didn't know. I knew the family who'd originally sold it. And when I had been at the house doing part of the Princess Margaret tour, I'd spotted the lady of the house wearing this in a photograph on the piano and said to her, "Goodness." And she looked away and she'd obviously sold it at this point. It had gone out of the family. So I knew a bit about this piece already before I was asked to look at it for the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. So it was just a lovely connection. And now, of course, this has been saved for the nation. So if you are interested in jewellery, another one to add to the list is the V&A Special Jewellery Galleries in London, probably one of the most important jewellery museum collections in the world, and certainly my favourite. So these were some of my key pieces that I've handled, key collections, a lot of royal jewellery, obviously. And after that was sort of 10 years in the auction houses, I decided that 10 years was a pretty good period of time to have got my experience and to learn a lot about the industry. And I decided it's now or never. I've got enough serious experience and I'm still young enough to set up my own business. And in 2011, I decided to do exactly that. So I set up a consultancy where I was buying and selling and advising on gemstones, doing valuations, and helping in source collections for collectors as well. And I also ended up doing quite a lot of academic work, writing and publishing books. But this was a lovely experience because I really understood how difficult the industry is to navigate for many people. So helping people as an independent specialist, independent experts, a very nice thing to do with experience. So that was my own business for a few years. And at the same time, I was teaching at HEAD in Geneva. So that was at the Haute Ecole Art and Design, teaching the history of jewellery, where I wrote the courses on history. Got to use a lot of my ancient classical knowledge, which I still use today. There are many ancient classicists, Greek Theophrastus and the Roman Pliny, who wrote about gemstones. So I always use a bit of that research. I still read some of the texts in the original. And at the same time, I published a book on Roman cameos, which was one of the biggest collections of ancient engraved gemstones in private hands, together with the tutor at university who got me into engraved gems. So that was Martin Hennig, and he and I had spent 10 years on this collection and finally published it when I was independent as well. So that was a really sort of a nice combination, getting slightly more into the academic world. And at this point, Gubelin asked me to come on board. Gubelin, many of you will have seen, I think, from the retail shop in Geneva, in Place du Molard. They asked me to come in as managing director to set up an academy to teach about coloured gemstones. And this was something which was just wonderful. It was like having my own business, but corporate stability. They just said, set up an academy, teach and do it as you wish. So I got to really design the strategy, build the business plan, did all the researching and the writing of the courses. I even taught all of the courses. For the first few years, it was really a one-woman operation. And I did this all out of Hong Kong. So first classes were taught in Hong Kong, then into Switzerland. And I even made a big decision and took the business actually into China, which was a really big step with partners that I had there. It was also, I guess, a move away from history into real modern gemology. It was very scientific. It was focused entirely on the gemstones, on rubies and emeralds and sapphires. I've worked very closely with the laboratory at Gubelin, which is probably even better known to us in the industry, known for testing gemstones. And this was really part of the remit, was to be able to explain some of those very complex gemological testing processes in an easy and understandable way for people that wanted to know more about the industry. And I wrote these classes as the sort of thing I wish I could have learned when I started. I put together all the information that I wish had been available, that I didn't just have to pick up on the way, something that if I was starting, this is what I would love to have known. So that was really a sort of a labor of love and a passion that project that I was very grateful, very much enjoyed putting together. And, you know, it was also a very international job. I was setting up the classes in Hong Kong, based in Lucerne, living in Geneva, taking the business into China. I don't think I spent more than a week, a month at home, not even that probably. It was a huge amount of travel. And that, again, is something else in our industry. It's a very international, globalized industry at certainly the higher level. In the auction houses, you're looking at one of four main locations, it's either Geneva, London, Hong Kong, or New York, which is where I spent most of my time. And, you know, the high-end gemstones are going to be the stones that are sold in these big international centres. So it's a very internationalised industry. Obviously, that's something that's changed, something we're not looking at now. And it's a big shift for us. But I'll come on to that just at the very end. And also, you know, I've had to keep up because of the interest in coloured gemstones, very much with the world market of coloured gems, handling all of the real world class gems over the last 15 years. I think I've probably, it's fair to say, there's nothing I really that's come up on the market that I haven't handled of an important nature. The Rockefeller Emerald was the world record emerald 2 years ago. That sold for 5.5 million, was the first stone to hit $300,000 a carat for an emerald. Graff Ruby, I'll never forget. I first handled that in 2006 when it sold for 3.6 million, came back again for sale at 2014 where it made nearly $1 million a carat. First time any coloured gem's ever done that. That particular stone was one that will personally stay with me forever. I remember the second time picking it up and just my heart just fell into it. It was my mouth was watering. The red and the material, the crystalline material of the gem, the red colour behind it and this glow within it. It was just the most spectacular ruby I knew at the time I would ever see in my life again. And I still stand by that 6 years later. And then the Bluebell of Asia, which was the world record sapphire, selling for $17 million. A friend of mine took that in for sale at Christie's. And I remember him calling me saying, I've priced this at $40,000 a carat. Do you think I'm crazy? And I said, yes. And then it sold for more. So I think another lesson there is that we never all know. You know, you're always learning in our industry. That's something else I love about it. The prices are always changing. The trends are always changing. You never always know. And it's always about learning. That's something I really adore about what we do. I'm aware of the time, so I'm going to sort of skate over a couple of the last slides, but this was really just to show you some of the most valuable diamonds I've handled, as well as colored stones, the most important blues and pinks and yellows. These are all diamonds, by the way. I think the top right-hand corner, I should mention, these were the really the world record most expensive piece of jewellery as a pair of earrings ever sold. It was the Autumn Leaves earrings at 15 carats each, vivid, coloured pink and blue, that sold for $96 million. And this whole page, I think it was around about $180 million worth of diamonds, to give you some idea of these sort of very high values. And of course, diamonds are a keystone to our industry, obviously. It's all very glamorous, all very exciting, and I can show you lots of blingy stones, important royal collections, but that's only one side of the jewellery coin. The other side is where these pieces come from, and that is the earth. And it's something that often gets forgotten in our industry. People, you know, I've just shown you all the exciting stuff. People forget how these jewels get onto your hand and around your neck in the first place. And that is, of course, from the jewellery mines. And this is something that I have discovered I adore in our industry, learning about where it all begins. You know, there's a very long and complex supply chain throughout the jewellery industry. It's very fragmented and it's very, I think, unhomogenized. But the mining at the very beginning, again, also very different in different countries, different gemstones. I've made it a real life experience, a life goal of mine, to try and experience as much of it as possible. Even treating and cutting of gemstones I've wanted to handle. But I have to say my heart is probably part of it is at the source of these gemstones. You know, I've been to so many mining sites. The first one I went to was in Thailand, where it was a sapphire mine in the back garden of somebody's orchard, where they were just sort of pulling out stones and washing them whenever they weren't fruit farming out of the season. Sri Lanka has become a big love of mine. I've been taking student field trips there every year for the last few years, obviously till last year. and going down the mines. That's where they really dig down into proper tunnels and shafts to get to the sapphires, and they river wash them as well. And that's some of the students I've taken on the field trips. And Burma, probably the most famous location for rubies. That's where those famous rubies I showed you would have come from. That was the second field trip I ever had, and I really fell in love with this country, the people, the mining, the location. It was really a wonderful part of the world to visit. I'm just going to quickly tell you one of the stories about visiting Sri Lanka, if I've got time. It's quite difficult as a woman to visit some of these locations, because it's traditionally a very male-oriented industry. I was not allowed down the mines in Burma. It's considered bad luck. However, having said that, the women are the ones that do the deals and handle the money. So it's not a misogynistic culture. It was just a superstitious one. Sri Lanka, on the other hand, I've always gone down the mines. And I had a really lovely experience on my second mine trip going down. You've got to be very aware that, you know, we're coming in from a Western culture. Many people came along with nice watches, nice earrings, and these people are working for a living, digging up the stones that we are enjoying for fun. And I was down one of the mines with some of the miners on my second trip, doing like talking to one of the miners underground, doing an interview on a camera, like in these tiny little spaces, and with a translator. And suddenly one of the miners started running through the tunnels screaming in Sinhalese and shouting. And I thought, oh God, something's happened in the mines. You know, this is a small, relatively dangerous space. Something's awful happened. And the translator was smiling and said, he's really happy to see you. And I said, I'm happy to see him too. I don't understand. And the translator said, no, you don't understand. He recognizes you from last year. And I said, yes, I recognize him too. It's really nice to see him. She said, no, you don't understand. After you were here last time, they had their biggest sapphire discovery ever in the mines, and they think you're really good luck. And ever since then, I've been invited back to these mines, and I stay in touch with the miners on social media. And the third time I went back, they said, did it again. We've had another big discovery. Keep coming to see us. And it just reminds you of the human element. You know, at every point in the stage on the supply chain, there's a very human element in what people are doing to produce these big gems for us that we only see in retail shops. Briefly, I've been to lots of mines. I went to Colombia to see the emeralds, which is the biggest location for emerald mining. That was one of the most unpleasant experiences. The roads were dangerous. It was highly humid, hot and wet, but still very exciting. And again, the miners were wonderful. Opposite end of the scale, mining in Montana in North America, where they find sapphires too, but in a mine that was completely open overground. And it's all done as a completely transparent supply chain and mechanized. So you get a huge variety in the mining. And I've even been to a few across Africa. The one on the left is very famous, the Cullinan mine. And this is where they first discovered the world's biggest 3,000 carat diamond that became the Cullinan diamonds in the British Crown Jewels in, I think, 1916, as you see it there in the Imperial Crown. And I went on a trip to visit the mine about half a kilometre underground, and they forgot we were there. The organisers just left us down there. After half an hour, I started to think, I'm never coming up. But thankfully, they came back and got us again. This one was actually very high on security and on social care of the miners. So I think that was just a complete myth. Again, opposite end of the scale. This is on the right is a small mine in Kenya with a friend of mine who's the first female artisanal Kenyan miner. So she took me down. That was just her and her brother working in a pit. So it's a huge variety, even just at one end of the scale. And like I said, I mean, I do believe if you're going to work in an industry, understand how it works at every level so that you can really fall in love with it. And that's what I've done with jewellery. Very lastly, just what I'm doing today, working at Gembridge as the head of business development. It's a new online regulated gem trading platform, which we're hoping is going to become one of the biggest centres for coloured gem trading. Obviously, there's been some huge changes in the world with COVID, online being one of them. But especially with gems, you know, we have a very physical global business. So we're looking at how we can now really work together globally in the industry and still keep the industry going. So there's, you know, a lot of changes going on. And COVID has obviously shifted the focus of many businesses and changed the turnover of everybody's. So it's a really interesting place to be right now. And you've just got to look at the opportunities and make as much as you can out of it. So to give you a quick overview, I've done a bit of everything from the mining, the treating, the cutting, the testing, the selling, the trying on. And it's simply to say, you know, I'm very lucky to have found an industry that I was passionate about. It's sometimes a very secretive industry, but it's very celebrated. And I'm just very lucky to have had these experiences. Hard work, be decisive, put the hours in, and whatever you do, just love it. You know, just love what you decide to do next. And that is the overview of the universe of jewellery. And I just want to say, if you enjoyed some of the bling, please follow me on Instagram, because I'm doing lots with historic stories together with the gems and the jewels. So there we go. That's a bit of the overview of the gem industry in 20 years in 40 minutes.
Wow. Helen, I'm just floored. I had no idea about all this that you've accomplished in your brief career. it's extraordinary. Plus, I have to confess, I just watched The Crown recently. And so seeing all these pictures of jewels and Princess Margaret, my mind just went, you know, back to The Crown and all these beautiful things. All these.
I meant to put the picture of Princess Margaret in the bath wearing the tiara, because that was in The Crown. That was actually a real, because her husband was a famous photographer, that was a real picture that was actually taken. So I'll put that in for next time.
I was just sort of going to ask you, is if you have watched The Crown, as many of us no doubt have, do you remember any scenes from there that involved jewellery? Any comments you might have on the...
I haven't watched it for two reasons. Okay. One is that some of the jewellery wasn't quite accurately done. And I do find that difficult. I find myself becoming one of those armchair experts when you see television programmes that are historic. But, you know, unlike things like Downton Abbey, which was brilliant because a friend of mine made all of the jewellery that wasn't original for it, and he was a jewellery historian. So I watched all of Downton, wonderful. The Crown, stayed away from that. But also because it's a historical subject, but with fictionalization, I struggle with that conceptually. So I tend to stay away from things that aren't true to history so much. But I heard it was wonderful for a lot of people.
I understand. They should have called you and asked for advice. We do have some questions from students. Amanda, would you like to ask your question?
Yes. Hello. Thank you for your presentation. Really amazing. I'm very, I don't know, just, it was so great. I had a question. When you look at the gems and jewelry and everything, how do you calculate the worth?
Amanda, that's such a good question. I don't know if any of you noticed, I had a slide that I quickly put the word pricing on, and I just didn't quite have enough time to go through it. It's the most important question, so spot on. It's one of the most difficult to answer because there's not a full amount of rules. And this is something that obviously I had to sort of teach myself at the beginning. And I'd say that I learned something quite early on. There's three ways of doing it. You use your head, you use your heart, and you use your stomach. And that's what I taught myself. It's a very Platonic concept, by the way. The ancient Greeks said this is how you should make decisions. And I think with jewelry and gem valuations, it's the same. The head is the financial calculations. So quite often when we look at diamonds, there's actually a standardized pricing list for diamonds, which we all work off, called the Rapoport list. It has price lists published every couple of weeks, depending on the size, color, clarity, and clarity of a stone. And it gives you a number and you just put it into a calculator, and then you work at percentages off it. So that helps you understand diamond pricing. Colored gem pricing is very difficult, which is also why I love it. It's why Gembridge is, you know, a really good place in the market to be right now, because the colored gemstone prices are quite obscure and there are so many variables. I happen to know that a really good Burmese ruby can be anywhere from $20,000 to $1 million a carat. But that's hugely broad. So you've still got all the other parameters of variables amongst that will change the price. That you just have to know from experience, which is, again, why it's quite a tricky industry. On top of that, where I get into the heart place is where you've got to think about the beauty of the object. It's not just an intrinsic fungible value. You've got a created piece of art. It might be signed. It might be antique. So, you know, this is sort of, do you love it? Is it going to be worth something to somebody else? And that's actually quite a valuable part. it's the one that I think a lot of the male specialists in the industry forget about. And I'm going to say, I think it gave me an edge. I looked at these pieces as a person that would wear them and love them. And I use my heart a lot, but I relegate it with the brain numbers. And then it's your gut. A lot of the dealers work like this. They just look at a piece and go $50,000. And it's a combination, I think, probably of being able to process those two very fast. So the answer is a combination. You need to know prices on the stones. You need to understand the market of how the antique and the provenance pieces will sell, and then take a personal angle on what you think someone else will pay for it.
Okay, so there's actually a lot to consider. I thought so, yes, but.
Great question there.
Thank you.
I have a question just because it's very general, and it will actually, cover some questions of several students here. It's basically, what is the art market looking for in terms of skills in case our students, and as you know, their psych, business, IT, international relations, and media backgrounds are interested in entering this market?
Super question, Beatrice. Thank you. I mean, that's actually really interesting for all of you. I think even more today than when I started, those are actually quite a lot of the skill sets that would be highly valued across the industry chain. I went in as obviously a gem jewelry person, very specialized, the old fashioned way of getting a job, right? Today, if I look at it across the board, a lot of the retails and the corporates want people with business degrees because they want to know how to increase their business. International relations, it's completely international business. Together with that, a huge amount of the industry is marketing and sales. So how you promote your products, that's a really, really big part of our industry. So the marketing and development side of things, super, super keen. Beatrice, what were the other areas that you said that people are working on?
It's basically psychology and IT and media.
I mean, again, I don't know any industry where media isn't important today, but I think if you guys, again, look at my Instagram, look at the other gem and jewelry Instagram pages, every big corporate I know is investing as much in their social and their corporate media as they are in the development of the creation of these pieces. You know, again, it's part of what I would call sales and marketing. So that's very key. And again, the way the industry shifted with COVID and with globalization, the IT aspects, that's something which old-fashioned specialists like I don't have, but we need more than anything. So I think all of those particular trainings are absolutely applicable within our industry, but I think it's fair to say they're probably applicable within most industries. I can say that if I were looking back on what I'd be choosing to be doing, one of those would be the one that would set me up the best in my life with the most options and opportunities. And the key answer I'm going to give there is, yes, there's an awful lot of opportunity across the board within the jewelry industry for those trainings. Pick something you love, find an industry that really talks to you.
Thank you. Any questions here from the students?
We have a question from Dominique. Go for it, Dominique.
Yes, I have a question. Do you think in the last maybe 20 years, the market and retail market and secondary market change a bit because there was more, people were more aware of some problems, especially when it comes to digging the stones, such as bloodstones, blood diamonds, for example. And do you think since COVID happened, there should be a whole new way that people could buy those stones in general?
Oh, what a great question as well, Dominique, spot on. And I think that's something that's really interesting for us in the industry to hear from your generation. I think a lot more of the younger generation are very aware of supply chain, I think would be a good way of describing that, and where things are coming from and how they're produced. It's a bit like saying, I want my food to be organic because I don't want it to have been badly produced, right? And this is something that absolutely, I'd say in the last 5 years in our industry, the absolute awareness that we have to be transparent and we have to explain where things come from and be answerable to how we're producing them has become really big in our industry. One of the things I worked on, the last few years in Googling was working on how to trace gemstones from where they're mined all the way through to give people that reassurance through a blockchain system effectively. This whole idea of, knowing where something comes from, for me, it's what we used to call provenance. Today, I would call it transparency. And I think those are really the modern updated words of what we used to discuss. But it's also, one of the reasons I was so keen to go to the mines and to tell the miners' stories. It's something that hasn't been focused on 20 years ago. And it's a whole aspect that gets forgotten about. And a key part of our emotional value in our industry is the people. You know, if you've got a ring, don't you want to know that a family helped find that stone and it's made their children go to school? I would want to know that. So we are working. It's something that I'm working quite closely on for Gembridge, is working through disclosure policies, working with other big organizations in the trade who really want ethical mining to be a key aspect to all of our industry practices. So this is something that's important, unmentionably important. It's a very, very good question. The second part, COVID changed everything. I would probably say that it's not so much that COVID's changed our industry, it's that COVID's made our industry change quicker than it was going to. I think we had globalized already. You know, I've been traveling around the world at all these gem shows for 10 years as it is. It was always going to be an international business. We didn't have the internet 30 years ago. We couldn't compare prices. You couldn't compare stones. You didn't have access. You had to go somewhere to buy something. We don't have to anymore. You know, I can go onto Gembridge and start to look for rubies, you know. And the reason that platforms like Gembridge are developing now is because of COVID. You know, we would have had an extra few years normally in any other days. But we're trying to find mechanisms to help us trade where we can no longer meet face to face in an environment of thousands of traders who might be spreading germs. So yes, COVID is help. I mean, I think it's helping us, but it's also the point here as well is the importance of adapting to changing environments. And our industry is very fast moving. It's very slow in some aspects, but aspects are very fast moving and you've got to adapt. And that's what I think so many of us are doing with COVID. Look at us here today. You know, we're not in a classroom together. Shame, but we've still made it happen. So that's the adaptability of the human race.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great question. Any more students having questions?
I am not a student, but I want to ask something, if I may, or I want to be a student. I am a student. I'm always learning, like you, Helen. what will be the role of AI in the valuation of gemstones going forward? I wanted to ask this. I know it's a provocation on my part, but do you regard it as a threat?
So that is, that's one of the toughest questions I could have imagined, but I like that, so don't worry. AI, now this is fascinating. I'll give you one example within the industry where this is potentially valid, right? Because there's so many different areas we could talk about. One is gem testing, right? You want to know where a sapphire comes from and whether it's been heat treated or not, because that affects the value. Traditionally, we've always said in our industry that you've got to have a human being look at it with a microscope and start to evaluate all these different aspects of what different inclusion patterns and different physical features have changed to make those decisions about treatment and about origin. Imagine you have a pure mechanical, an online database from thousands of stones that have already been proven, and you take pictures and you have that analyzed by only a computer. Boom, gemological laboratories become redundant. Now, the other side to that, I personally don't believe that any computer or visual AI aid is ever going to be able to do that better than a human being, because we have a three-dimension of image. We have a concept of information that's historical that we are able to balance. And in gemology, it's a bit of an art. So you've got this idea that, yes, you've got XY equals Z, but sometimes in gemology, XY equals 3. And you need to know 6 other types of parameters why that's been affected differently, that you can't always make quantitative. There's a huge amount of qualitative information in our industry. So I think it's going to revolutionize it in some of the fundamentals, but probably not in those human level decision making. But again, that's probably the same in most industries, I would imagine. So yeah, I guess we're going to see many more changes than just 2 years of COVID, right?
Yeah. Well,
thank you so much.
Yeah, actually also for me, thank you so much. This was a blindingly beautiful PowerPoint presentation. It's really something, and it showed also the progression of how you build up your career, but also that you actually went up to these shops and say, how can I get in, or what do I need to know? I mean, that takes a lot of initiative it takes a lot of guts. And I think that really helps to test if one wants to go into a business that one hasn't necessarily studied, you know. So, but even if you have studied it, you know, where do you start? And can only imagine the pressures working for these big auction houses too. I mean, you made it sound like you know, it kind of all worked out. But you know, you must be extremely good in your business to be able to get to these. To do these collections at such a young age already, and it was just I don't know what to say. So thanks a million, and this was just great.
Thank you so much. I think that's what you said is spot on, and it's the same with every industry. You know, in ours in particular, there's not a career path. There was no rules, and I had to just ask people because there was no information anywhere. But this again, I think, is a great lesson in life in general. You know, if you want to find out stuff, go and ask people. Don't, you know, there's stuff on the internet, but the human connection and networking. Some of those people I met and I knocked on the door 20 years ago, I'm now doing top end business with, and they remember me. You know, the networking, you've got nothing to lose to go and ask people, hey, how do I get into your industry? Because you might be working with them in 20 years' time, and it'll be a great way of getting in. So just give it a go, right? But thank you. Yeah, I look back and I'm not sure I would do it now. I was terrifyingly brave.
Okay.
Thank you, Beatrice.
So, well, thank you very much. Juliana, do you want to add something, or Nancy? Or
Can I ask a question?
Sorry.
I was wondering, how do they make the tiaras into multiple different, like, necklaces and bracelets and stuff? I'm looking at your Instagram, and when you post a picture, you can kind of see when you post, like, from the tiara, like the one with the blue turquoise stones, and then it's a girl on the next picture with the necklace. So they just assemble it, or...
They're really clever. I mean, this is especially something we don't see so much in jewelry today, but we did 100 years ago, where when they made a piece of jewelry, because, I mean, the creation was all by hand. So you make a piece, it's going to be much more valuable to make that than it is today. So they wanted to be able to say, well, I'm going to make a necklace plus a tiara, plus a pair of earrings, plus brooches. And what they would do is you make individual units of that piece of jewelry. So maybe a little curly section, a flower section, and they're all set at the back with screw fittings. So what they would then do is have sections with tiny little screws that would screw into a frame. So it's the frames that are removable for a tiara, a frame for a brooch maybe to have the clipping on the back. The necklace, you just had the clasp at the back, so that was added on. So it's just the idea that you can add a part to individual units to turn it that into that particular jewel. Does that answer your question, I hope?
Yes, thank you.
Super.
And you have a lovely Instagram.
Thank you very much. And again, that's just a passion project. Again, I love the subject. I love the pieces. And if it makes people happy to look at them, great. Job done.
Well, you know, also you gave us a fantastic tour of all the different elements that you have worked on, you know, teaching and researching and going into the mines and the question of, you know, human rights, the transparency, you know, that things become transparent. And so, and all these areas are areas where there are jobs. You know, the focuses are now shifting, and some things are never shift. Some beautiful gemstones, and there. So it was just a wealth of information. So thank you so much for your time. Is there anything, you know, because we're going now to pass the time. So thank you very much. Don't want to keep you.
Total pleasure. I mean, like I said at the beginning, I'm really keen on education in general and helping people learn more about our industry and just learning every day about things that they love. So it's just been, I've been in Geneva for on and off for 20 years, so I'm very keen to help the Geneva community, and I'm just really, really pleased to have been here today with you all. It's been such a lovely thing that Juliana asked me, and Beatrice, thank you for being so welcoming. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.
Lovely. Take care, everybody.
Bye. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Fantastic and fascinating. Bye.